This is the best of Golic and Wingo podcast.
Oh, good morning. Glad you're with us. Golic and Wingo, ESPN Radio, ESPN2, presented by Progressive Insurance. All phone guests, as you know, join us on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line. Mike Golic Jr., Trey Wingo here with you. Remember, Joe Kelly doesn't forget, ladies and gentlemen. We had a little bit of a humdinger in baseball last night.
You know, there's obviously a ton to talk about.
Yes.
But there's nothing like a baseball, good old baseball fight.
Sort of.
When there's never really a fight in baseball in a COVID era that takes on even a more different look.
What if I told you the virus actually broke up a fight last night? Because that's what it looks like. And as Major League Baseball gets ready to reckon with so much that's going on right now and everything that's happening with the Marlins, last night, while I still don't condone it, was something that felt like everyone sort of needed that release. It felt cathartic on a lot of levels.
You know, we have the COVID situation, the Marlins to talk about, but there's real sports. We got 3 days left on this show. So, you know what? It's pretty nice to talk about some real sports, even if it's about the fighting in the real sport. At least it's talking about sports.
Nailed it.
Yeah.
So here's what happened last night. If you didn't stay up late, if you haven't heard, there was a game between the Houston Astros and the Dodgers. The Dodgers won the game 5-2, but in the middle of that game, Joe Kelly, former Red Sox, who we'll get into that part of it, by the way. Everybody said Joe Kelly's my new hero. Well, hold up there, Dodger fans.
What if I told you?
Yeah. You need to go full deep dive onion on this before you go down that road. So Joe Kelly's a reliever for the Dodgers, and Alex Bregman is at the plate with a 3-0 count. And amazingly, somehow, Joe Kelly lost total control of his ability to throw a baseball and threw it about 90 miles an hour behind Alex Bregman in the vicinity of his cranium. And as you might imagine, that upset some of the Dodgers and some of the Astros, who they came running out of the dugout, and then the Dodgers came out of their dugout, and they all sort of said, well, we can't be doing this. We're not 6 feet apart, but we're not actually getting into each other and all this. All this because the Dodgers and Joe Kelly wanted to remind everybody we still haven't forgot that we all think the Astros
I remember that we thought the fans and the booing that would go on, but there's no fans in these games. So it wasn't just Kelly. You know, he did it to other batters, including ended up throwing it inside on these curveballs to some other batters, struck out Correa, and then is going to be memed all over the place because of some of the faces Joe Kelly's made as well. So this one has a few tentacles on it.
Joe, I would say, let's not let it get lost in all of this baseball minutia that Joe Kelly might now be entering the upper meme stratosphere here at this point. Pouty Joe Kelly face, boohoo Kelly, as I've heard it called. All of these things have a chance to be a transcendent bit of meme and GIF culture online right now, all because he gave everyone what they were looking for here. We came into this season wondering, would the Astros hate tour, would the revenge tour still be something that went on even amidst an abridged season? And boy, did we get an answer last night.
Absolutely. So it was clearly an attempt to throw at Alex Bregman or behind him as a retaliation for, hey, you guys cheated, all that kind of stuff. Again, side note, all these Dodger fans who love Joe Kelly now, he was part of the Red Sox, who apparently, according to baseball, did cheat to beat your Dodgers in the 2018 World Series. So make sure you process all the information here before
He's
you go run out.
He's their teammate now, Trey.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. That 2018 World Series doesn't matter anymore, apparently.
Kelly, by the way, was not on the Dodgers in 17
yes.
when Houston and the Dodgers played. But, you know, he's their teammate now. So you knew it was going to happen after the game that Kelly was going to be asked about that pitch and was it intentional or not.
That 3-0 count on Bregman behind him, was that a message? Was that a mistake? What happened there?
It was a ball, obviously. It wasn't my best pitch. I mean, it was ball four, and walked him, and never good to put a guy on when you're leading the game. So some of that, you know, I wasn't feeling the greatest, wasn't the most comfortable. Took me a while to hone in my mechanics.
What is your perception of how the rest of that inning unfolded?
I mean, I threw my curveball. I guess I didn't take too kind to it, a curveball. I mean, it is what it is. You know, walked a couple guys, was able to get out of the inning, finally made one good pitch for the punch out, and, you know, was able to keep the lead where it was at, especially with us not playing, you know, the best baseball of the first four games, be able to come out and win against that team. You know, they're a good team.
I wouldn't get caught grinding my feet on Eddie Murphy's couch. I got a little more sense than that.
And listen, right. no pitcher is going to come out and admit it and put themselves in a position to be fined and or suspended. So you always get that, oh, that one got away from me.
Wasn't my best pitch, Mike.
It wasn't. But, of course, you go to the other side and you go to their manager and Dusty Baker for the Astros on if that pitch was intentional.
Balls get away sometime, you know, but not that many in the big leagues. And, when you throw a 3-0 fastball over a guy's head, I mean, now you're flirting with his, ending his career. Then a couple other guys, balls are close. And then, you know, what really enraged everybody is when, you know, he told Carlos, I mean, he struck him out. And he told him, nice swing, and see, what are you supposed to do then? And then what upset me is that the umpires warned us. You know, why don't you warn him? You know, he's the one throwing the ball, and, he's the one that started this mess in the first place. So, I didn't like it at all.
Now, it was interesting that Kelly didn't get warned in all this. Now, again, the bench clearing didn't happen on the Bregman. It happened on the Carlos Correa.
Yeah. Yes.
He got a couple more close pitches. Then he ended up striking Correa and gave him that pouty face, which you're going to see all over the internet. I mean, it was a very demonstrative pouty face
that
Kelly gave Correa.
If no mixed messages. Yes.
If you're going to go full pout, you might as well. Joe Kelly did it.
It was incredible. And that's what led to the benches clearing. Everybody kind of half walked, half ran out. I think realizing as they were getting close to one another, saying, A, this is COVID, we can't get that close, and B, we've been told there's going to be real discipline if there is a fight and you start grabbing other guys and actually get into a fight. So I think that was all realized. You never really get a crazy fight anyway in baseball. Occasionally you do. Occasionally you get you guys throwing, but for the most part, you know, you're out there jawing, and this was jawing even at a bit of a distance as well.
Joe Kelly, like the image of him yawning after sending that pitch over his head too, all of it just played into the bad guy role in this situation. And like, to be clear, I look at this and still say, if you're throwing at someone's head in Major League Baseball, you are not tough. That. Like, it's not a good thing. I'll never really condone that and all of that. Like, every baseball hardo in my Twitter mentions can take a seat. Like, you're not a tough guy because you hum 96 past some dude's head. I'm also not going to go right now and say, because of COVID, well, you should just go punch him in the face, because normally that would be the recourse here that I would say, all right, if you're really about it, go ahead and like, let's have that out like adults. But right now you don't need to be doing any of that. Like, it's COVID-19. What they did last night is exactly what Major League Baseball was hoping, which is everyone would kind of realize that's not worth pulling the trigger in that spot. But that being said, Joe Kelly is going to be a hero for a lot of people who hate the Astros.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. We don't think this is going to be the last time this happens, right?
Well, I think Dusty Baker, didn't he? We can quickly get that. He mentioned if this was going to continue.
Dusty, do you expect that this will be a continuous thing with your team this year, of people throwing at you guys?
Well, this is the first time. You know, they said they warned everybody from the beginning, but, this is the first time it's happened. And it's the first time it's happened, and this isn't the first time I've seen Joe Kelly, in a skirmish like this. So, they need to talk to their own guys. I'm not going to talk to my guys. No, my guys didn't do nothing. Okay, so.
I feel bad for Dusty because he wasn't there for any of this, and he's having to clean up somebody else's mess.
And think about Kelly. He's the smart one. He got away with it all, right?
Oh, yeah.
Going down the road, I mean, one pitch like that, there's going to be a warning. Kelly, he pitching through all kind of inside pitches, making faces, doing the whole thing.
And this is not his first time. He's had a bench-clearing brawl between the Yankees and the Red Sox. Yep. So I think he hit Tyler Austin with a pitch when he was playing for Boston. So Joe Kelly is who Joe Kelly
is. Yes, he is.
And this will probably not be the last time that the Astros face a little music for people reminding him, hey, things are weird in baseball right now, but we still have.
We remember.
We remember all of it. Speaking of things being weird in baseball, coming up next, one major league team is shut down for a week. There was, believe it or not, some positive news to get out of all of that, and we will get to that after this.
Golic
and Wingo.
And Wingo.
Mm-hmm. Trey Wingo and Mike Golic Sr. Jeff Darlington, you of course know him as Florida Man, who has been posting some amazing photos of his fishing expertise over the last.
I was going to say, Dad, you've got to be pretty jealous. Jeff is living your dream of being out on the water fishing damn near every day and hauling in some winners.
I had to stop watching because I got so jealous of what he was doing.
So, Jeff, congratulations on being very successful in your latest fishing adventures.
Well, you know what, guys? When you're trying to quarantine in South Florida, the epicenter, if you will. You gotta get creative, and if you can slam some monsters.
But get on a boat.
You're invited. You know, get down here. Let's go.
I appreciate that. I may not get down there right away, in all honesty, but in the future, I will get down there because I would love to be hooking them fish you were.
Yeah, we'll meet somewhere in a very desolate boat in the middle of the ocean. How about that?
We'll put a pause on that for now.
By the way.
We'll do it that way. Jeff, it's amazing. It wasn't, just a year ago that Jared Goff got $100+ million guaranteed, and now we're talking about almost that same kind of money for Joey Bosa. It's remarkable how quickly and how fast the escalation of salaries continues to rise in the NFL, even with everybody concerned about what may or may not happen this season.
That's right. And, I mean, I think that is an indication that teams are still comfortable, despite what will be pretty massive revenue losses this year, with the long-term future. And it feels like the fact that you have 10 years of labor peace, like when I was talking to an executive before we got real deep into kind of the drama of this offseason with COVID, he was basically saying this isn't going to be like Major League Baseball because the major difference is 10 years of labor peace. It gives you so much more flexibility. So when you can kind of project that these television deals are going to be big, that you've got labor peace, then you can still go about your business in a fashion that doesn't necessarily cause you to do anything that you wouldn't normally do. And extending Joey Bosa to a monster deal falls definitely within those lines.
Interesting note, Alex Spanos bought the Chargers, San Diego Chargers, in 1984 for $72 million. Now, 36 years later, Joey Bosa, when he signs the extension, is guaranteed $78 million. Right out of the gate. It's pretty amazing. So I'm wondering, will this hurt the next level down? We always know the stars are going to get paid. And you look at the guy last year, Melvin Gordon, who tried to hold out to get more money, and they basically said, not happening. We don't think you're worth what you're asking for. Joey Bosa, certainly worth what he was asking for. So the mega guys are going to get their deals. Is the next level and then water trickling on down, will it hurt the rest of the league?
I continue to wonder about, to me, the most interesting contract in the NFL, and in this case, I'm curious to see how it's impacted because I think it could be, is that third-year contract. The guy that's the rookie star, like Jamal Adams, who wants the deal after his third year. To me, that's where teams continue to be able to save money. If you cave to those players after 3 years, and in many cases I say cave, Ezekiel Elliott, Christian McCaffrey, Patrick Mahomes, I mean, naming some pretty big stars, you got to find a way to keep them. But to me, that's where you've got to save your money. You've got to find a way to get through those rookie deals without overextending. So I think general managers can still get creative. To me, no, I mean, I don't think that they're going to nickel and dime, you know, the backup guard because they're trying to make up the salary cap projection. I just don't see that. Again, there's so much wiggle room. Yes, it's a hard salary cap, but in this NFL, there's so many different ways to kind of navigate the cap in a way that will get you through it. I really don't sense that much concern in the people I talk to about trying to sort of get through what is undoubtedly a challenging time for them, but I don't think it's one that they think will alter their rosters all that much.
Jeff Darlington with us here on Golic and Wingo. Speaking of altered rosters, yeah, we saw a lot of that going on yesterday, namely in New England, as players in the NFL are starting to exercise the opt-out agreements that just recently went into place, choosing to not play for a litany of reasons, Jeff. So I'm curious, we saw a big wave, and especially as we mentioned in New England, what are you hearing about the prospect of other guys continuing to take this out?
Well, they've got, August 3rd is the day that they've got to decide about their opt-out. To me, I'm not surprised at all about the high-risk opt-outs. I'm really not. I mean, there's a lot of guys, and this was sort of the union's point people that I've spoken to on the union side early on is that, look, I know people think of these athletes as being the exceptional world-class athletes, but there's a lot of guys with high BMIs. There's a lot of guys who believe the black community is more affected by and more vulnerable to COVID. And as a result, there were people that were potentially concerned about that aspect of it. So to me, though, it wasn't the high-risk opt-outs that has me surprised at all. It's the guys that are opting out, not getting the accrued season, getting that $150 essential loan that they have to pay back next year. Those guys, to me, I'm fascinated by that decision because I just don't perceive NFL players to oftentimes put their health above their paycheck. And I that sounds so cold, but I don't know that I'd be any better when you're putting millions of dollars in front of my face and saying, yeah, you can kind of get through this if you pay for this, you know, if you take this chance. I'm surprised that there's been more guys doing that so far, and I'll be very curious to see if even more do.
Well, that's what makes what happened in New England yesterday so fascinating, because we've had six now opt out for the Patriots, including arguably their best defensive player in Dont'a Hightower, right, who was basically the quarterback of that defense. I mean, their entire linebacking core is now gone. And I love this tweet from Adam Schefter. One NFL executive texted Schefter saying, you know, Bill is masterminding this somehow. and then Adam said, for what purpose? He goes, I don't know. And that's what's driving me crazy. I mean, the level of paranoia about what Bill is up to is also fascinating in this.
Right. It is. I mean, I'm all for the humor. I'm just throw this out there because I think people believe anything these days. I don't think that is the case.
Correct.
But I do appreciate the humor, and I think that, you know, it wouldn't, I don't think it'd surprise anybody, but to me, it's so interesting because these decisions, as everybody will tell you, are just so personal. You know, like when you go down the list of players and you look at the reasons, you're like, okay, yeah, okay, all right, that makes sense too. You know, so it's just so curious. And with the Patriots, especially, like, we always, I think, are apt to be like a little bit suspicious, like, what's going on there? And is this just coincidence or is Belichick up to something?
Jeff Darlington joining us, our ESPN and angler, great fisherman. Angler is fishing, Mike, in case you didn't know that.
I did know that.
You did? Yeah. Okay, that's pretty impressive.
But the way you sold it, our ESPN and angler.
And angler.
Yeah. ESPN angler. And angler.
ESPN
which is, by the way, far more complimentary than Florida man, but
yes.
but basically synonymous, you know?
Yes, that is very true. So, Jeff, with the Jets and Adam Gase, Jamal Adams is out. He's gone, basically talked his way out, even though they won't admit that. Adam Gase saying some of the right things to the media, Sam Bradford saying some of the right things to the media. Bottom line of all of this, is Adam Gase going to be on the hot seat this season?
I don't think because of this, per se. Like, for me, Jamal Adams can say he can pull the leadership card on Gase all he wants. I mean, I'm not convinced that if Joe Douglas offered him the contract that he wanted, that Jamal wouldn't have been walking into camp singing Gase's praises. So, for me, I feel like it's a little bit of a, you know, you do what you got to do to get paid, and if it means take down the coach along the way, so be it. And Gase is vulnerable to that. He's not, I know Adam pretty well. He's not like, you know, he's not some social extrovert who's super great with people.
See Taco Meme at his hiring press conference.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's just not his style. But I will say that he's also not the kind of guy, you'll have guys they'll go to battle for him. I think he's very much a guy who wants to, like, internalize his locker room. Like, if you're in those walls, you will be his guy, and he'll find a way to make that happen. So some of the things that Jamal was saying, I don't agree with or see as traits of Gase, despite the fact that I certainly am more than willing to point out to you guys and to Adam Gase himself that he's not exactly, you know, a people person.
Bubbly.
You know what?
And real quickly, Sam Darnold, not Sam Bradford.
Yeah. And listen, it happens. Sam
Bradford might have just signed another $75 million contract.
No kidding. Isn't that the truth?
It's remarkable.
Exactly. He went in on the Royals with Mahomes on that one.
Is Bradford still in the league? That's a dead serious question. He's not, right?
He's going to turn up somewhere, Jeff. Just wait. It's gonna happen here
you
eventually.
You could literally tell me that he is the backup quarterback. I mean, I do this for a living. You could tell me he's the backup quarterback in Arizona, and I might believe you.
I think they might believe you, too.
He's currently listed as a former American football quarterback.
All right, there you
okay.
go.
Well, if Wikipedia says it, then it's definitely
true. It must be true.
Give it time. That was where me and Jeff were citing papers in college from, so respect Wikipedia's yeah. name. Jeff, speaking of people with interesting personality types, let's say that. Aaron Rodgers was pretty forthcoming yesterday talking on a podcast on The Ringer with Kyle Brandt. I want to play you a little bit of a clip of this and then ask you a question.
There's like a ridiculous decision that has to be made, because if you're just you and you can stay healthy, the team has to either choose about we're going to move on from Aaron Rodgers, which is sounds nuts, or we're just not going to play our first round draft pick. How does this end?
I think probably the former. I think that's probably what happens. Based on, just the circumstances around everything, you look at, just look at the facts. You know, they traded up, they drafted him. I would say they like him. They want to play him.
Obviously, the pronoun in question here is Jordan Love, quarterback Correct. Out of Utah State that they took in the first round. And so I'm curious, Jeff, as we get ready for everyone reporting now to training camp, does Aaron Rodgers saying this out loud make it less awkward or more awkward going into Green Bay Packers training camp now?
See, I think it's an Aaron thing. I think that's a psychological kind of thing where you're basically saying, like, I'm going to use this as a chip on my shoulder, even though I'm also stating that they clearly don't, it's kind of like this thing, they don't really want me anymore kind of thing. To me, the really funny part to me is that, like, Jordan Love has not even stepped on an NFL field yet. Like, can we relax about the idea, and I include Aaron in this, I think he's doing this deliberately, but the idea that just because they drafted him in the first round to replace Aaron Rodgers, that he will be good enough to replace Aaron Rodgers. Yes, that is obviously the plan, though, to his point. That's the plan, because you don't draft a guy in that situation if it's not. But those plans fail. You know what I mean? Like, have we not seen it plenty of times before where a guy gets picked even earlier than Jordan Love and ultimately fails? Like, this does not guarantee anything just because Rodgers replaced Favre, and now Love will replace Rodgers. It's just not that easy. And anybody who suggests otherwise is probably a Packers fan who has been rewarded with the glory of having two Hall of Fame quarterbacks back-to-back to play, take them through like 25 years of the organization. I just don't think it's that easy.
It isn't that easy, and it may not be, but that's certainly the stated goal for the Packers by doing
no
this.
Doubt. So no doubt.
And you're right. It may not happen, but that's certainly the plan they want to happen by having done this.
And as such, Aaron's probably doing a service to himself by you talk about whether it's awkward or not. Sometimes you just got to rip that Band-Aid and make it feel it, make everybody kind of feel it for them to understand what they're getting into. And to me, in part, I think that's what he's doing here.
All right, Jeff, go wet a hook, will you?
I might have to do some work today instead.
Damn it.
Thanks, bummer. Jeff.
All right, brother, we'll talk to you soon. Thanks.
All right, see you guys.
Golic.
I tell you what, a great sports night last night, no doubt about it.
And Wingo.
What a day, what a show, what a time.
One, two, three, four.
Doug Glanville. Doug, I love Joe Kelly's explanation for that pitch behind Alex Bregman. Yeah, it was a ball. You think?
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's, look, Kelly, he's wild, and that can play to his advantage in his deniability. There's no doubt that that's been his game over the years. He struggled with command. That one's not going to sell very well, but given the circumstances, there's no question the Dodgers, a lot of bad blood between the Dodgers and the Astros, particularly the Dodgers feeling that they didn't get justice, they didn't get vindication for 2017, and it probably cost them a World Series.
Joe Kelly once tried to throw a baseball into a net in his backyard, instead broke a window, and player's resume is brought to you by Indeed. Find the high impact, hire your business needs at Indeed.com/high impact. So going forward with this, he threw at Bregman. We know that. We knew where this was going, and we wondered what was going to happen with the Astros this year. So where will it go next? Because Kelly never got, warned here at all. It was actually the Astros who ended up getting warned in this thing. So how much does this continue going forward, and where does baseball need to step in?
Well, baseball's got to step in right now, and they have to because, as you mentioned, this is pandemic baseball. You can't have a brawl. We see the circumstances that the Miami Marlins are facing and how quickly this can be contagious. So you're not trying to invite the elements of how this spreads to increase those elements by contact and being in a scenario where now you're fighting for 5 minutes and yelling at each other. It's too risky. So the perspective will no doubt come immediately from Major League Baseball, and that's still not going to satisfy the Los Angeles Dodgers. So, players have been known to say, all right, well, I understand that, but you have to remember the other element of how we're playing. There's no fans. And I think as a player, you expect and know that, you know, if I'm looking at the Dodgers' perspective, you're saying, well, they didn't really get any heat for this, okay? They kind of are getting a hall pass because we're in a pandemic. And they would have been on a tour where they would have been booed out of every stadium other than Houston. And to a large degree, players feel that that had been justified. And so you don't have that sort of element of playing through that kind of stress and playing through and say, okay, well, you know, if you have a great season despite that, people would have let them know how they felt about 2017 and what happened, you know, thereafter. So the Dodgers are all the more upset because it feels like nothing's happening and we're just playing baseball, not acknowledging that, you know, we just had a whole sign-stealing scandal.
Message firmly delivered, yeah, and received last night as the Houston Revenge Tour at least gets kickstarted against the Dodgers there. But you mentioned we're playing pandemic baseball, and we've heard now from Major League Baseball that the Marlins are going to sit until at least next Tuesday. They're going to be tested. They're going to be in a holding pattern. The Phillies that they played against are going to be in a holding pattern until at least Friday when their series with the Blue Jays would begin there. So I'm curious, as you've seen the schedule reworked and everything around this, Doug, what you've made of Major League Baseball's response to the rash of positive tests for the Marlins?
Well, that's what they have to do. The issue is, and you know, although I'm an engineer from the college days, I know the incubation period comes from part of this, right? 3 days to 2 weeks. And so when you're testing positive, it's for that moment, it's that day. And so this could also still, you could be negative and it could still be sort of forming over the next 2 week period. So they test every day, but they're still not sure when something could come on. And so you see the dominoes that hit the Marlins, right? Day one, all of a sudden this goes from three to basically like 17 people. So that's what they're concerned about. So they're going out as far as they can, and they're still not committing to that. Say, okay, we're going to push back, and they're hoping they'll get a bunch of negatives and then be able to move forward. But right now they're very concerned, and as should be. And then, of course, the same story holds true for the Phillies because they could have been exposed, and it didn't hit right when they tested, but it could be lurking there for the next, you know, 10 days. So they're going to have to always adapt. And, yeah, schedule-wise, it's going to be a disaster because they have to continue to move pieces around. But you're going to be faced with this reality that at the end of the season, someone is going to play more games than another team. One team's going to have a different, and you're going to have to go off winning percentage because eventually you're just going to run out of dates. And yeah, that's going to be a challenge for the competitive balance that they're looking for.
Literally everything about this season is just going to be weird and unusual. I'm going to have to accept it, as Doug Glanville, former big leaguer and current baseball analyst with us, joins us. But Doug, look, the Marlins thing is a mess, and you're certainly hoping that that incubation period you talked about does not pop up a ton more tests. And that is the negative, and that is a huge story. But there is the other side of this, that they've done all these other tests, and to this point, nobody else has had this kind of outbreak. That's a message that baseball, I think, needs to make sure they're putting out there as well.
Absolutely. And we are all looking to sports, Major League Baseball, for answers and what we've been facing for quite some time, this entire year, basically. And that is this health crisis. And here is an environment, baseball in particular, that has unlimited resources to a large degree, large resources. They have super athletes that are generally in this low-risk profile. And to some degree, this is an experiment, and we're watching and learning from it. So they need to continue to be transparent and communicate, because it's not just for baseball, it's for larger society to pay attention to how this actually works. And they have done, you know, what they could. They didn't have a bubble, and that was a choice they made that was thought out. And so they're trying to work with what they have. And they, you know, right now, it seems like they've contained it in around the Marlins area. As long as they approach that with humility, recognizing how contagious this is, as we definitely have found out, you know, they'll continue to make efforts to make this season happen as safely as possible. We recognize that, you know, this is not something that's totally in baseball's control. And so they are hopeful they can continue to play. That's why they're moving forward. They did their contact tracing, and it didn't, you know, work out for the Marlins, but so far so good from the standpoint of where it is.
Doug, over the years, you know, asking former ballplayers like yourself, usually the answer is, hey, when during a season do you start to know who you really are? And for a lot of times I would hear June is when you kind of start figuring out who you are. Well, we know this is a different season, 60-game schedule. Yeah. When can we start to figure out who these teams are in this shortened season?
You're going to find out very quickly because, once again, you have this external force that is beyond anything these players have ever encountered. I mean, most of us haven't encountered. And so the ability to be a team has started when they, this, you know, entered spring training or summer camp in this case. And because you're facing so much, your family's exposure, the concerns, and how well you're able to sort of come together around that in this commitment through something that's really scary. All the players are watching. You know, you don't have to be a Marlin to have this high level of concern because you know this is everywhere. This isn't just in Miami or this particular team, and you see how aggressive it can be. So they're all, you know, responding to that and trying to coalesce as a team now, and they have to because even the numbers, you know, you could lose 10 days for maybe the Marlins end up, you lose all these games, and all of a sudden if you're on a 52-game schedule and you go 10-17, you might be out of it. I mean, yeah, you have this expanded playoffs, but it could change very quickly. So you're going to see these teams and find out who they are, you know, within the first 30 days of this season. And because so much else can go wrong off the field, as we've seen with the Marlins, that you're going to have to play your best baseball right out of the gate.
Yeah. Yeah, by the way, kudos to the traveling secretaries for all the baseball teams who are having to rearrange all these schedules. It is going to be something else that probably a lot of people aren't thinking about, but the logistics of that alone, based on everything, absolutely remarkable. Doug, as always, we appreciate the time, my friend. Thanks so much.
Okay, guys. Thanks for having me.
Golic and Wingo.
It was all sort of one big giant jello mold.
Very interesting where that went.
Dr. Alan Sills is with us. Dr. Sills, thanks for being with us this morning. I'm just curious because I know every sport is different and you're dealing with your parameters and your situations, and baseball is certainly different, although you two sports will not be bubbling. How much attention to what the Marlins outbreak has done has the NFL been sort of watching?
Well, good morning, and thanks for having me. And I do want to speak to that. Before I do, let me just say a quick word. I want to congratulate you guys on the great run that you're having and give you all best wishes. I know the show is winding down. I got to tell you that I've been a fan for a very long time. And as a surgeon, lots and lots, really countless early mornings that I've been driving into the hospital listening to your show. Mike, in particular, it's kind of going to seem that mornings aren't the same without listening to you in that circle. So I do want to make sure I tell you guys congrats and best of luck down the road here. But
I appreciate that very much.
Thank you.
Very, very much heartfelt. Long time fan. So, but with regard to your question, absolutely. We're watching this very carefully, as are all other sports. And I think that's been one of the really positive things that's come out of this situation as we look for positives, is that we've had tremendous collaboration with all other sports, not only around America, but around the world. I mean, I've been on calls each week with Australian football and the Bundesliga and English Premier League and these other leagues. So we are definitely listening to and learning from each league, and we're sharing our learnings with each other because we're all facing the same set of challenges and we all want to try to get this right.
So along those lines, is there anything in the protocols or guidelines in place right now that you would look to tweak at this point after seeing what went on in baseball?
Well, I think we're still waiting for some of the details to emerge, Mike, about exactly how things may have proceeded there and what they might change. And so we'll process that information. But I think we recognize that this is something we've talked about for a long time, that we expect in the NFL and in every league, we're going to have positive cases. They're going to pop up no matter how careful we try to be, because this disease remains endemic in our society. So I think what we have to look to is how can we most quickly identify any new positive case get that individual isolated away from the team environment, make sure they get the appropriate care, and try to avoid a more widespread outbreak. So I think that's something we'll continue to track and look to. I think also there's a great educational opportunity here. I think, again, it just shows how quickly something can spread around a team, and how players, coaches, staff, everybody just has to be vigilant at all times. This is something where we're facing a tough opponent in this virus, and we just can sort of never let our guard down on or off the field.
Dr. Alan Sills with us, the NFL's chief medical officer here on Golic and Wingo. Dr. Sills, and we were talking about this right before you got on, but part of what we saw happen with the Marlins that so many people looked at and said procedurally seemed off was the fact that their players, their manager, were in a group text essentially deciding if they felt comfortable enough to play after the initial four positive tests. I'm curious, if the NFL is in the same situation where you've got positive tests on a team and there's a decision to be made about playing, who is going to be making that? Because it seems like leaving it up to the players did not work out well in this instance.
Yeah, definitely the information is that we have on positive tests is shared with the club medical staff immediately. They're the ones that get the first notification, and the league and the Players Association also get notified. So that's a discussion that we would have as a group. Obviously, we would be quickly on the phone with team medical staff, but the league and the Players Association together, our medical advisors, our medical staffs, we would consult together to do what we think is the safest thing for everyone involved in those situations.
Dr. Alan Sills with us, the NFL chief medical officer here. So we're at the point now where we've used this metaphor a million times, that you know where the runway is no longer available, where the plane is ready to go, as players are showing up for their testing. As from a strictly medical perspective, Dr. Sills, what can we do to minimize the potential spread of this disease in a sport where you cannot socially distance? I mean, in baseball, you could literally play an entire game without touching another human being. It's not possible for a single play in football.
No, you're absolutely correct. We've said throughout that football and physical distance really don't go together. So I think we have to address that in a couple of ways. One is, obviously, we want to try to show up to the field, practice field or game field, in an uninfected state. And that's the point of our testing and screening programs, is to do frequent surveillance and, again, quickly identify anyone who might be a new infection and get them removed from those environments. And we've also done a tremendous amount of education saying that people have to quickly report symptoms. You know, I mean, how many times have any one of us woken up with maybe a little sore throat or a little nasal congestion and thought, gosh, it must be my allergies again that are bothering me or something like that? Right. You know, we can't make that assumption in the COVID era. We have to say, you know, any symptoms get reported and we're going to pull those individuals out until we can get them appropriately tested. But I think it's also critically important what we do off of the field. The choices that we make, you know, making sure that masks are being worn everywhere, making sure with good hand hygiene, respecting physical distance, staying away from crowded restaurants, bars, et cetera. All of those choices are going to have a huge impact on the vulnerability of players, coaches, and staff becoming infected and keeping them hopefully in a position where they're not showing up on the field with a new infection. And additional to that, I'll just say, I think you guys are familiar with the chips that we're using that everyone's wearing that tracks proximity, so that, again, we can go back and figure out who exactly did have a close exposure to a newly infected person and quickly test and isolate those individuals as well, again, whether that's on or off the field.
NFL Chief Medical Officer Dr. Alan Sills joining us here on Golic and Wingo. There's been one prevailing question that we were looking for an answer for here. It's been figured out amongst league and union, the testing. Union wanted every day. League wanted every other day. Now it's testing every day for 2 weeks, under 5%. You continue, or it goes to every other day, over 5%. It stays at once a day. You have a separate independent lab providing the tests. We know there are rapid response tests out there. It doesn't seem for the NFL money should be an object here. Why isn't there just flat-out testing every day, Doctor?
Yeah, it's a complex issue. It's a great question, and I think you have to look at it in several different ways. You know, we've said consistently that we don't think we can test our way to safety. And again, that's not just an NFL position. That's what public health officials and epidemiologists and infectious disease doctors say as well. And those are the people we've consulted with, Mike. You know, this isn't a decision that I made or the commissioner made on our own. We consulted with all of these experts and asked them, what do you think is really the most appropriate way to screen people and keep a surveillance on our population, but also to be responsible to the test supplies and to the larger medical community? And so when I say that we can't test our way to safety, what I mean by that is
none of these tests are 100% accurate. So that means that it's not just testing. We still have to do PPE, physical distance, all these other things. We have to reimagine and re-engineer every aspect of our team's existence to try to minimize risk. And at the same time, when you test every day, you know, everyone sort of gets this false sense of security, like, oh, okay, now we're all not infected. We don't have to do all those other things. That would be flawed thinking here. So it's a balance between trying to detect new infections, but also being responsible, a number of tests that we use, as well as, you know, sound epidemiologic principles and adhering to that, all those other factors that we know really do a great job of reducing infection. So at the end of the day, someone described it like this. Testing really tries to help you close the barn door as quickly as you can if a horse has gotten out of the barn. It's not going to prevent the horse from getting out of the barn. We have to prevent the horse from getting out of the barn by all these other measures that we do besides testing.
And Dr. Sills, I think that's so important because from a medical perspective, you can do everything that you're supposed to do. You can do all the screening. You can do all the testing. You can do all of these things. But at the end of the day, whether or not this is going to succeed is based on players doing the things that they need to do when they're out of control of the facility, correct?
You're absolutely right. It's not just players. This is coaches. This is staff. This is everybody. You know, we've called it a team ecosystem, and we've said that everybody in that ecosystem, players, coaches, staff, athletic trainers, you know, medical staff, they're all going to share the same risk to each other because they're around each other every day, but they're also going to share the same responsibility. And that means that each person's decisions, those personal choices they make throughout the day, both with the team and when they're on their own, they're going to share the responsibility because those choices are going to have a huge impact on keeping the entire team safe. And I think that is absolutely the key message for our entire season. It's something that we'll have to continue to reiterate time and time again. We've already been doing that. We've done a lot of education on that point, and it's something that will continue.
And with that, the preventative measures are always the best way to go about all this. But worst case scenario, we talked about the decision making leading up to what could potentially happen should an infection compromise a game. Does the NFL have plans? Have they planned for potentially having to lose a game or two to a disruption should something like this happen?
Yeah, we obviously recognize that that is a possibility. I mean, I think that the two words that I've used consistently and we've all said have been flexible and adaptable. We're going to have to be flexible and adaptable throughout the entire season. And so we absolutely recognize there's a situation where we would not think it's safe for a team to play or even for the league. So that's something that, again, we won't make that decision in isolation. We're going to take all of that data that we're collecting via the testing and the tracing. We'll work with the NFL Players Association. We'll work with the infectious disease experts, population health experts, public health authorities, and we'll make the best decision about what's safest for our players and all our personnel, as well as what's the most responsible course of action as members of the broader public health community, because we take that responsibility very seriously as well.
Yeah, we're all on this adventure together, and we're trying to figure out how we can navigate our way toward the end, and we'll just have to see how that plays out. Dr. Sills, as always, we appreciate your time. Thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Hey, thanks for having me. And once again, all best wishes to you guys. I really, really have enjoyed being part of your show and certainly being a listener through the years.
Thank you, Dr. Thank Sills. Appreciate that very much.
Golic and Wingo.
Let's not expect too much. There's only one person out there that's expecting way too much out of this guy too early. We know who that is. It's his father.
Brian Windhorst. Brian, we have to say at this point, the bubble thing has worked almost to perfection. Are you surprised that so far that things have gone as well as they've gone in Orlando?
Yeah, I mean, it's been terrific. I mean, on paper, this is what it was supposed to be. On paper, this is why the NBA didn't, you know, react negatively when they had a bunch of positive tests. When they first got together, they said, okay, we've got to get the people who are sick weeded out and get them healthy. And, you know, just the overall scale of this. I mean, just when you watch the game itself and you look at how the courts have had to be set up and managed so that every team not only has what they need, but they also have all of the local advertisements for the local TV broadcasts, and they have all the graphics packages. I mean, just the technical lift on this, not to mention getting food for 1,000 people, not to mention keeping everybody safe, is just tremendous execution. And the NBA needs to be complimented to the highest order that we've even got to this point, and the players themselves for having the faith that the league could do this.
So along the lines now of now on the court and eight ramp-up games and then the playoffs, and I would imagine the more time these guys play together, the better they're going to feel. That being said, we just talked about Utah and the Clippers. Do you think they are really going to try and get that two seed so they'd have more time to play together and not have to face the Lakers until actually the conference championship?
Yeah, I mean, I think the difference between the two and three is negligible because there's no home court. The difference between three and four is a little bit more, but it depends on what your team wants. You know, I think the Houston Rockets, for example, I think they feel good about their chances against the Lakers. I think they would love to get in the number four seed to try to go after them. But there's a lot of flexibility between four through seven, and that could really make a big difference on who your first-round opponent is. I mean, maybe you think that the Nuggets, who Mike Malone said earlier this week, the only two times they'd played five-on-five were their scrimmages, the actual games that they played, because they had so few players due to all kinds of things, including the virus. Maybe you think that the Nuggets are a little bit vulnerable and you want to align yourself with them. You know, but there's a lot of flexibility in there between four and seven that will affect the first-round series and the first-round challenges. Like, the Lakers are probably pretty confident against anybody, but I know that the Lakers, if you had to get their honest opinion, would probably prefer to play the very young, never-before-in-the-playoff Grizzlies than they would want to play Damian Lillard and the Trailblazers, who were in the West Finals last year.
Talking to Brian Windhorst with us here on Golic and Wingo. And Brian, to that end with the Lakers, obviously everyone reacting to the LeBron's announcement that he won't be going zero dark 30, 23 this year. He's going to have, you know, his social, his phone up to keep in touch with his family outside of the bubble. But I'm curious overall for him, his playoff routine has been something that's been pretty regimented. He's been used to being in the postseason almost every year. And after a year off last year, now coming back for this version, is LeBron doing anything to tweak what he would normally approach this as, obviously with all the other circumstances taken into account?
Yeah, Mike, that was a huge challenge for LeBron. LeBron had, over the last decade, really developed, you know, his own system for ramping up, for, you know, every day tightening the bolt a little closer as you got to the playoffs. And you could see it. You know, you could see him in March, he and the team playing their best basketball. And so his challenge during this downtime and the restart was, how does he recapture that? And I think if you watch the way he has taken part in practices and these and what you've seen of him in scrimmages, his focus level has been very sharp. He is out there playing at full speed. He is not looking like he's taking these scrimmage games as a practice. You would never watch the way LeBron's played these games and say, oh, that's how he plays in a preseason game. He is, and he's trying to set the tone for his teammates because he's got this huge challenge at this point in his career, which is to not let this opportunity slip and to try to recreate back. Transport everybody back to the middle of March where it stopped. And then in these next eight games, make it feel like the beginning of April. And then by the first game of the playoff, make it feel like the second week of April. That's what he's got to do because that's what he's seen success in the past.
Brian Windhorst with us, our NBA insider, brought to you by New Ford Super Duty. Built for tough. Clearly, we know LeBron is tough enough for whatever lies ahead for him. But you mentioned it. Get that team back to where they were March 11th. And, Brian, there are different members on this team. J.R. Smith, Deion Waiters. How critical are these games for those guys? Obviously, J.R., we all know, has a history with LeBron. Just make sure he gets the time on the clock right. How important is it for what LeBron wants to do to make sure those guys are prepared for what they need to do?
Right. I think, you know, honestly, for the Lakers, you want Deion and JR to be options. You don't want them to be main role players. I think if you look at the history, in fact, of JR's career, the more a team has had to rely on him, the more he's let them down. When he can be a value added player where maybe on a certain night he can help you, and if he's not doing it at night, you can just sit him down. That's what you want to have. And Deion is a guy who, even though I know he has a history of hitting last second shots, I think if you look at on balance, there's been quite a few games where his play down the stretch of games has not helped a team win. So what you're hoping for if you're the Lakers is that you don't need Deion and JR that much, that you can go touch that button maybe once in a series or, frankly, once every two series, and hope that they can help you in a 5 or 6 minute stretch in a key playoff game. If the Lakers are relying on those guys, I think it's going to be an indication that they've got bigger problems. And, you know, right now, while some of their guys are building back up and some of the guys are taking time to strengthen themselves, they're going to get more playing time. And I expect over the next 2 weeks, those guys are going to get playing time. But you really need your core players. Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, Alex Caruso, those guys have got to play at a very high level for the Lakers to have a chance.
All right, Brian, let's get to the let's get ahead of ourselves segment of this program. NBA PA Executive Director Michelle Roberts said the NBA might need a bubble for the 2021 season, which, again, you think about it, you're like, oh, that's next year. Well, it's under 5 months away if they plan on starting next season in December. When we get to that point, do you think next season will start in a bubble?
Yeah, so from what I understand, the league office is working on, you know, a multiple different scenarios. What happens if we start the season like any normal season in December and everybody plays all 82 games on their home arenas? What happens if we have to create another bubble or multiple bubbles? You know, how long do you keep teams in it? Do you rotate teams in? Or do you feel good about the chances of a vaccine or feel good about the chances of selling tickets if you push it back? And do you push it back into the winter or even into the spring? I think all of those are on the table. And the difficulty with anything right now is it's impossible to make, you know, accurate future predictions. And so I think definitely one of the things that is possible is that next season becomes one giant bubble, but it doesn't mean that it's going to happen. I think what Michelle Roberts was saying in that interview was that this has gone better than they thought it would. And when she looks around at the country right now and she looks around at the other sports, she feels good about where the NBA is going. I think there's no way to know. And I also think that even though the television revenue is enormous and the ratings are going to be good, the NBA cannot function without fans in the arena. Maybe they can function for a little while, but the way that all the money works, it will never sustain. So part of this is going to be the owners and the players weighing whether it's worth waiting so the fans can come back so that everybody can be made more whole.
It's going to be very interesting to monitor with that, but we've seen the other bubble sports, the WNBA getting started last weekend and some others, certainly having success, so the NBA hoping to continue to draft off of that. Wendy, we appreciate the time as always, Brian. Thanks.
Gentlemen, it's always been an honor. Take care.
Golic
makes me want to vomit and then punch you square in the face.
And Wingo.
Oh, he's saucy today.
I would you spill? Did you spill?
He tried to hand me his iPad.
I wanted to show you something that I think even you would object to as the greatest foodist food of all time.
That I think was food.
I have something to show you. Oh, I saw this going on.
Is that just disastrous?
I saw this going on last night. So explain what that is, the description of the picture tray for the people that can't see.
The Nerdist put this out on their timeline on Twitter. The next time you're craving something sweet and savory, how about a hot dog Rice Krispie treat? And they have a hot dog Rice Krispie treat with ketchup, mustard and relish on it. And it looks absolutely disgusting.
Listen, if anybody likes that and wants to eat it, more power to you. I, on my work at worst drunk, I would not eat that.
As I said in my tweet response, get behind me, Satan.
Wow, that is just awful.
I thank you for that because you've now validated my food take, and I appreciate that. All right. So Keenan Allen was very upset with the NFL Top 100.
Triggered.
Very upset that, among others, yes, there was very... What'd you say?
Trey, the power rankings. It's Trey Wingo's power rankings.
Yeah, I like football season, all the things that go with it.
Trey's top three, or something like that.
The most ridiculous title of all time.
I am sweaty.
There it is.
You know how we say things should end on a high note?
Yeah.
This show's not.
Do you think... was there ever a high note?
Like, no, that's true. Consistently low bar.
Hey, as I always say, keep the bar low enough so you can just get over it on the next day.
Boom.
That's where we are. So Keenan Allen very upset with the NFL 100 that he was behind other wide receivers, specifically Mike Evans, Chris Godwin, and Tyreek Hill of all people. So he was like, there's no way they're better receivers than me. Faster, yes. And look, Keenan Allen's a very productive receiver.
Yes.
Very good receiver. There's no question about it. So that, we thought, because of that little spat, we'd take a look at my top three-ish wide receivers for the 2020 season.
Three-ish wide receivers.
Yeah. And again, here was my criteria. It's not about production per se. It's about, does the defensive staff say, when we're playing this team, we got to make sure that guy doesn't beat us.
Okay.
That was my thought process going into this. Okay.
All right. I like it.
So understand that going in.
Understood. Make it ambiguous enough that I can't hit you with a stat that hurts.
Thank you very much. So we're going to start at the top because I think the first couple are always going to be obvious.
Okay.
Here we go.
Number one.
Still, Quintoris Lopez Jones. Julio Jones, freak show among freak shows. I think the Falcons are set to have a big year this year with everybody on that offense being a former first-round pick. I think Julio's going to go off. Julio Jones still atop the list.
I got no issues there.
Tough to argue. Again, I think everybody's going to have the same three or four on the top, just a matter of what order. I'm not going to sit here and get crazy over that.
Okay, here we go. Number two.
Number two.
New team for DeAndre Hopkins, which I think is going to be very good for him. Larry Fitzgerald on one side, D-Hop on the other, and an emerging Kyler Murray to get him the football downfield. I think DeAndre is going to have a massive year.
Yeah, I have always been a big DeAndre Hopkins fan. He's always been, I think, for the last few years, you could have made an argument he was the number one wideout. A little bit of an off year for him by his standards last year. Zero problem with him. Perennially underrated for still one of the best wide receivers.
He belongs in any conversation when you're talking top wide receivers.
Okay, here we go.
Number three.
This one may catch some people off guard. I have the Cheetah at number three. Mm-hmm. Tyreek Hill, Wasp, Super Bowl. Game on the line, get it to him. Look, he's never going to have the numbers that some of these other receivers are, but I guarantee you he scares more defensive coordinators than almost anybody.
Great
else.
Route, no doubt. The Wasp, poor coverage as well. You can throw that in.
Play design.
They set
play
it up design. Well. Yeah. Well, yeah, every play is designed to succeed, and every defensive play is designed to stop the offensive play that's designed to succeed.
Yeah.
It was bad coverage and a good route.
Yeah.
I know Michael Thomas is probably next, and I think you have Michael Thomas too low. That would be my only thing. But a team picture of the first three you mentioned and Michael Thomas, I think would be good in anybody's book. But I have Michael Thomas higher.
I think this speaks to one of the things that we always hear and that kind of complicates this conversation is speed is usually the first thing that defensive coordinators are looking for. Who is the guy that can ruin me vertically in
Correct.
All of this? Mm-hmm. Even though that might not make you the best wide receiver.
And no,
pure wide receiver, this is not Tyreek Hill, but unique wide weapon, this is absolutely him.
It's more of a terrified list than anything else.
It's more of the combination, too. Him and Mahomes together should be illegal.
And again, you can't separate that. That has to be part of the equation
when you go forward with this. I understand.
Okay, so now we get to 3A.
Another
hey,
one.
Stop it!
Hey, stop it!
Number three.
And that would be Michael Thomas.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, like I said, those four...
Head and shoulders,
I think
right?
in most people's top four, you took a snapshot of the best four receivers. It's going to be that four. You may have a different order, but I don't have an issue.
I'll be very interested to see who the next one is outside of this because I know who the impetus is for this conversation, and I know who a lot of people are going to beat the drum for that should be here.
All right, so we got those four, and let's move on to 3B.
Let's go to number three on the list, okay?
Do you want to say who you think it is?
No, I want to hear you say it.
It's Mike Evans.
All right, that was not either of the ones I thought I was going to get there, but probably one that should have been involved in that. I think when you get into this range, the three-pack of guys that are going to get conversation, and Mike Evans, you could make a legit claim, should be up at the top, as you could Keenan Allen, who's the impetus for this conversation, and Davante Adams with the Green Bay Packers.
Well, the list isn't over.
And I get Mike Evans because you're not doing because he just had 67 receptions.
Yeah.
He didn't have a ton of receptions, but I know you're not going on the stats. 67 catches, but he did have over 1,100 yards, 17 yards a catch, and what a hell of a target that he is and a red zone target that he could be. So he deserves his due up near the top somewhere.
Listen, at this point, to your point, Junior, you said it, bigger matters. 6'5", 231 pounds.
Great target.
Catch radius is going to be enormous. So that is a large part of the equation for me at this point.
So I need to know who's next.
Well, hold on. Here we go.
Another one.
Number three.
I am sweaty.
3C is Keenan Allen.
Okay.
Wow. You know what? So here's going to be part of my argument for why I think Davante Adams is being wronged in all this, because as we talk about some of the difficulties, and Mike Thomas, I think, gets rightly bumped up for being the only weapon for the last couple of years in New Orleans and still managing to get the majority of touches. I get he's playing with Aaron Rodgers, but it ain't like they've had a ton of other weapons besides Davante Adams, who came into this league as a first rounder and had to suffer a fair amount of slings and arrows for not producing the way people thought early. And all he's done since then is, in an off offense that has shipped off most of the receiving talent Aaron Rodgers liked, he's been the consistent option there, and he's been the one that performs. So I think there's something to be said for performing on an island in a way that Keenan Allen and that offense have had other weapons and all. The second rounder, excuse me, I forgot that's the whole knock on the Packers there, but you get the point. Higher draft pick there that has now turned into the only steady option for Aaron Rodgers, and a really damn good one.
No, he is just under 1,000 yards this year, but you certainly have to dig for that one because of the team that's around him. Yeah. I agree with you, Mike. I do think he is underrated, but I don't think I would put him ahead of Mike Evans.
Would you put him ahead of Keenan Allen, though?
Wow, Keenan Allen.
Keenan Allen last year, 104 catches, almost 1,200 yards, six touchdowns.
We're not going on stats, though.
No, but he is productive.
He's super productive. He's super talented. Yeah. He's probably a better route runner than he gets credit for, but as is, like, Devontae Adams is a great wide receiver.
I think I would put them on the same level.
So should I go to the next one on the list?
Yes.
Number three on the list. Stay with me.
3D for Devontae Adams.
Oh, there you go. Look at that.
I get it's going to be like picking your flavor of ice cream when it gets down into this range here, because there really are two tiers. There's probably that four-pack up top.
Exactly.
Although you could even – Mike Evans is maybe like the line of demarcation in between the two.
Yep.
But then after that, I think this it's really a dealer's choice with that last group here. But there's just something about Devontae Adams. Like, Mike Evans also had the luxury in that offensive. Certainly, Jameis Winston, for all the bad, there was a lot of good in him going bombs away. And, oh, by the way, you've got Chris Godwin, not Goodwin, Keenan Allen, on the other side of him as another Pro Bowl wideout in the last year.
Yeah. And I'm going to finish it up with one that I – Last one. You ready? Here we go.
Another one. Hell no. What the hell?
Number three.
3E, Adam Thielen.
Huh.
Very, very productive.
Here's a guy that,
very underrated.
Here's a guy that I think, if he has another year close to what he had last year, is going to be, if you do this list again next year, wherever, could be on it.
Yeah.
Cooper Kupp.
Oh, I thought long and hard about Cooper on this list.
Let's put it this way.
Hurt last year, I know, but boy, this past year, what a year he had.
Well, and I think it's like Cooper Kupp and Stephon Diggs are two of the guys that you look at going into this season, that if they come back, and Diggs obviously has a different situation now in Buffalo, new surroundings, but.
Yeah, and the point there, I understand Diggs, Minnesota chose to keep one and move another one.
Yeah, I mean, listen, part of that, I don't think that's always emblematic of who's better in that situation.
That's fair. But, you know, I just think that Thielen has worked better, for whatever reason, better with the quarterback, too.
And for Keenan Allen, if you don't like this, try and get Trey's Twitter handle correct.
But Keenan, I do love you and respect you as a player.
@WING10Z.
Yeah, not Wingoos.
Not Wingoos. Wingoes.
So there you have it.
For those that don't know, when he tweeted to those guys, he got Chris Godwin's Twitter handle wrong.
It was poor Chris Goodwin.
Some Chris Goodwin had to be going, what the hell did
I
say?
I wear your jersey, man.
You.
Stop, mister. I don't even know you.
Wouldn't it be terrible if he was a diehard Charger fan?
Oh, my gosh. Oh.
Why are you hurting me in this way? All right, coming up, does Houston have a major problem now as it moves forward for the rest of the baseball season? We'll get to that after this.
This has been the Best of Golic and Wingo podcast. You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or just ask your smart speaker to play Golic and Wingo. Plus, you can check the guys out live weekday mornings from 6 to 10 Eastern on ESPN Radio and on ESPN News.